voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 11 o'clock. This is Richard Lawson. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country has settled a score after the death of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Beirut. He was killed in an Israeli airstrike yesterday. Hezbollah said they wouldn't stop fighting. Speaking to the BBC, the Lebanese MP Najat Saliba gave her reaction to his death.
I think the people who followed him are going to be devastated. It's really an unknown right now how things are going to turn around, especially that Iran still has great influence on the Hezbollah followers.
Lebanon's health ministry says Israeli airstrikes killed 33 more people today. In the US, President Biden reiterated his calls for a ceasefire and said the Hezbollah leader's death was a measure of justice for his many victims, including hundreds of Americans. The MP for Canterbury, Rosie Duffield, has resigned from the Labour Party and told the BBC that the Prime Minister's team cares more about greed than making a difference. There have been days of revelations about donations, including thousands of pounds of clothing gifted to Sir Keir Starmer. In an interview for tomorrow's Sunday with Laura Kunzberg, Ms Duffield said she felt voters and activists were being taken for granted. Well, our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus has been reading her resignation letter.
Her letter is deeply critical about Sir Keir Starmer's policies, the cuts which she says will affect the poorest, and which she says are cruel and unnecessary. His leadership, she says, is uninspiring, and accepting gifts, she says that sleaze, nepotism and avarice are off the scale.
The Metropolitan Police say three people have been charged with criminal damage after soot was thrown over two Van Gogh paintings in the National Gallery in London yesterday. A man and two women, one of whom is 77, will appear at Westminster Magistrates Court on Monday. The attack on the paintings happened only hours after two activists from the Just Stop All group were jailed for damaging the gold frame of one of the artworks in a similar stunt 2 years ago. A hurricane that swept through several of America's southeastern states has killed at least 53 people, including seven in Florida. The state's governor, Ron DeSantis, described it as a gut punch to coastal communities.
In this part of the state, we saw really monumental storm surge in excess of 15 feet. And that is really, really destructive. So as you look around here, you know, you see some homes that are now just rubble. This stuff's coming in, it's fierce, and it just is unstoppable.
A SpaceX rocket is heading for the International Space Station with spare seats on board to bring back two astronauts stranded there since June. Both Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams are meant to be in space for only 8 days.
If you love your pop, this is right up your street.
Pop Top 10 with Scott and Rylan.
We've picked some of the most hotly contested questions of all time and decided to settle them once and for all with the help of some special guests. We're taking it very seriously.
I can't let things like that slide on this show.
No, come on!
What are you on about?
Don't put words into my mouth.
I won't, darling. You're spatting them yourself.
Search Pop Top 10 to listen on BBC Sounds.
Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Today, Hezbollah has confirmed the death of its leader, Hassan Nasrallah, after Israeli strikes on Beirut last night. Our BBC Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bechega, is in Beirut.
The population here is suffering, and it is suffering a lot. 100,000 people have been displaced because of this violence in the last few days. Many of them coming from southern Lebanon, they're coming here to Beirut. Schools have been turned into shelters, and hospitals are struggling to cope with the sheer number of casualties from these Israeli airstrikes.
The BBC security correspondent is Frank Gardner.
What is Hezbollah? It's both a massive militia. It's the biggest non-state or the most powerful non-state military force in the world, with a huge arsenal of missiles provided by Iran, mostly. But it's also a political party. And for 32 years, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah has overseen the transformation of Hezbollah.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said tonight that they have settled the score with those responsible for the deaths of countless Israelis. I've been speaking to the Economist correspondent in Jerusalem, Anshel Pfeffer.
Back in October, immediately after the Hamas attack, there were many people within the Israeli security establishment who thought that Israel should attack Hezbollah in Lebanon then. And at that point, President Joe Biden called up Benjamin Netanyahu and urged him not to do so. And then Netanyahu listened to him. I think at this point, Biden is much weaker. He is a lame duck.
Some of the headlines tomorrow that you'll be waking up to. The Sunday Telegraph, Labour MP quits over freebie scandal. The Sunday Express, Kemi's vow to stop the boats. The Observer, Iran threatens vengeance over Hezbollah's chief's assassination. Here's how to get in touch.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Call free 08085 909 693. Text 85058. Text will be charged at your standard message rate.
Visit bbc.co.uk/5liveterms
for our terms of use and privacy notice. Stephen Nolan
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Right, so let's get stuck into the paper review. Author, political commentator Emma Wolfe is with us. Good to talk to you, Emma. Evening to you.
Good evening, Stephen.
Hello, Emma. And Eva Santina, political core at joe.co.uk. Hello, Eva.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening. Can we start with the Sunday Times, right-hand side, front page, headline, Duffield quits Labour over cruel winter fuel cuts and freebies. Well, I'll read from it. Rosie Duffield has resigned as a Labour MP, blaming Sir Keir Starmer's cruel and unnecessary policies and the freebies row that is engulfing him and his party. Duffield has become the fastest MP to jump ship after a general election in modern political history, says the Times. She is writing to the Prime Minister today informing him of her decision to resign the whip in with immediate effect, Emma.
Yeah, this is huge, really, in terms of where Labour are and how the freebie gate, the controversy and the rows have overshadowed their conference, which has just ended. Rosie Duffield obviously is an independent voice amongst Labour MPs. She's vocally not been happy about their stance on women. She feels very betrayed by how Keir Starmer hasn't sort of supported her. She's had huge sort of amount of hate mail and things like that from the whole trans issue. And she has now written to Keir Starmer at this time, talking about, I mean, one of the lines, her letter is absolutely blistering. It's all over Twitter. And it's a very, very interesting letter. It's two pages. And I think it sums up in really quite impressive eloquence what many on the left actually are feeling about their party at the moment. She's obviously really unhappy about Freebiegate. She's condemning Starmer for accepting gifts worth over £100,000, including the clothing, the glasses and the accommodation that we know were paid for by Lord Ali, the Labour peer. But a line from this letter, Stephen, if I may, the sleaze, nepotism and apparent avarice are off the scale. This is Duffield writing. I am so ashamed of what you and your inner circle have done to tarnish and humiliate our once proud party. She's very angry about the decision to retain the two-child benefit cap and to axe the winter fuel payment on pensioners. And she's really, really unhappy at having to defend. She also talks about Starmer's, you know, lack of interest in his constituents and lack of interest in many of the MPs in the party, lack of interest in the PLP. All of that. I think it's very, very damaging for Starmer.
I guess one of the key questions here, Eva, is perspective in terms of how many others, both inside and outside the party, are starting to pay a lot more attention to what some of the press are calling freebie gate.
I suppose so. I do think that this is a rather, I don't think this is going to be the beginning of a landslide. So Rosie Duffield, if we're talking in terms of Labour factionalism, has sort of been an island unto herself for quite some time. She doesn't really fit in with the traditional left. She doesn't fit in with the new intake. And there's a crucial line in her letter where she says that actually she was overlooked, essentially, but for certain jobs, because the 2024 intake have been given precedent, and she criticises Starmer for focusing more on them than focusing on to the backbenchers who've been with the party for quite some time. But in terms of the wider discussion, you know, I mean, this, you know, the debate over donations is absolutely not going away. And I think the next phase of this is going to be second jobs. That's going to widen out, which many Labour MPs have. They have quite a nice side hustle while they're doing their job. And that will be the next big scandal that's going to hit.
The Sunday Telegraph have this on the front page as well. Labour MP quits over freebies scandal. Does the fact that this is coming so early on in Starmer's premiership, is that an advantage to him in that clearly he's going absolutely nowhere? So it's better this is all out there. He says he won't do it again and the party moves on, Emma.
Well, you say he's going absolutely nowhere, but there is a lot more to come out. There is clearly a leak problem. There's clearly a problem with communications and getting control of this situation. So I just don't, you know, how fast things can move in politics. I don't think you can say clearly he's going nowhere. We don't know what is still to come out. There are still a lot of very weird questions to be answered, and we don't know what else is to come. Can I just come back on what Ava said? You know, yes, Rosie Duffield is known as an independent voice, so this isn't that surprising, and maybe it was that she was overlooked. But don't you think, Ava, there's something about the way she articulates, I think she's capturing at the moment, and of course it's not going to bring down the government. It would, you know, you'd need another 79 to even make, you know, cause Starmer any trouble, but isn't Rosie Duffield articulating and encapsulating something that a lot of Labour voters and a lot of Labour MPs are feeling at the moment about the freebie gate, but also about the kind of betrayal of pensioners, about the betrayal of the two-child benefit cap, the private school thing, you know, where some special needs children are going to be have to move out of private schools? Isn't she articulating that?
I think she absolutely is. And I've spoken to a number of Labour MPs this evening from, you know, all factions of the party. And essentially the similar line is it's the right thing to say, but it's the wrong person to deliver the message. Yeah. Because unfortunately, there's not going to be the sort of domino effect that falls on afterwards. I mean, the text that I've been getting from Labour MPs this evening, unfortunately, not one person is regretful that she has left the party. I've had texts like good riddance. I've had one cabinet minister tell me it was just one word. They just said good. Unfortunately, she's a very unpopular figure in the party and has been for quite some time. And actually, there was a move to deselect her a few months ago. That didn't go through. And there was thought at the time that she would do something like this. She would wait until after the general election and then she would resign the whip because she knew she had the Labour ticket. And that would mean that she was still in Parliament for 5 years. And then she could campaign on the things that she cares about, which are, you know, she is gender critical and she has been a voice for that. She will campaign on that rather than having to fall in line with the Labour whip. But you're absolutely right. She has captured the mood of Labour MPs, Labour activists, Labour voters. Every single person who has some kind of vested interest in the Labour Party thinks exactly what she has said in that letter. I was walking around conference. These are the sort of sentiments that are being given to me. However, everyone is quiet at the moment because they want to give Starmer time to bed in.
How many of them are at it? How widespread do you think it is across our political establishment, the receipt of these freebies?
Can I just say that every single MP takes donations, every single one of them. You cannot fund a campaign without a donation. So there is always money going into MPs' coffers. The question over what Starmer received is not what he received, but it's why he received it, and why did the person who was donating to him then, why was he given the privilege of such access to Downing Street? He was given this pass to Downing Street, an incredibly prestigious pass. That's the question.
Isn't it more than that, though? Because the clothing allowance was described as office expenses, wasn't it? A clothing allowance, it's a far stretch, is it not, to describe that as an office expense? And here you have someone presenting themselves as being different from the others. Does it not speak to Keir Starmer's judgment?
I think it does, and I think that it's I don't want to say the wrong thing about anyone, but I think that it's not just office accommodation and funding a campaign. This goes beyond that. There are so many questions about the sort of personal involvement, the idea of a family staying in someone's penthouse apartment for their child to revise for exams, you know, dates not tallying with the GCSE season, just a more personal level of involvement in someone's life, choosing glasses, choosing, you know, paying for a personal shopper for their wife, all of that. And I think, and you may not feel this is relevant, guys, but I do, you know, that we know that Starmer doesn't really need, he doesn't need a couple of thousand here and there for clothing. He is a wealthy man. He is a wealthy man. He was DPP. He's been a barrister for years. You know, he's well paid. No matter how you estimate his personal income, I think it really does speak to his judgment, but also his honesty, because I don't think we're getting the full story. I think if the whole thing had just been declared properly and it had all come out at the beginning, we'd probably be over this by now. But it's the way this is being leaked out, drip, drip, drip. And even the jokes. I mean, there's sort of the joke in New York a few days ago, oh, I'd like this penthouse. I think he maybe just doesn't get how dishonest this all seems, how furtive and weird it all seems to hide it and to allegedly be filming COVID lockdown videos in someone else's home, perhaps even with family photos in the background. It just, something doesn't ring true. And that's why this story is not going away.
Yeah, I think they're certainly trying to portray it as a right-wing tabloid story that's, you know, there because they can't find anything else to criticise the Labour government on rather than actually dealing with the issue. And, you know, Starmer is being advised by a number of people who work for Tony Blair. And if you remember, Tony Blair, you know, he had been, in effect, taking donations. He'd been, you know, going out and about. He'd been pretty close with the chairman of the F1, or the CEO of F1, Bernie Eccleston. But that scandal didn't really arrive properly until about 3 years into Tony Blair's tenure. But what I'm saying is, if the judgment or the advice that is being given to Starmer is coming from these people who work from Blair, you can sort of explains why he doesn't really seem to care. Or
does he need? Should he need that though? I mean, really, it's quite straightforward. It's a very bad look, and it's not really necessary. I mean, should he really? Obviously, they need their advisors on more complicated issues, but I mean, one would have hoped as a barrister that he would understand, and as a politician and as someone who was about to become the Prime Minister, kind of you can see how all this looks. I don't think he needs advisors. I think he should understand that. Does he have no political, you know, nous?
Across all the papers tomorrow, let's move on if you don't mind. Across all the papers tomorrow, obviously, is the situation concerning the killing of Nasrallah. The front page of the Sunday Telegraph tomorrow, Biden hails killing of Nasrallah as justice for thousands of victims. The article reads, Joe Biden last night hailed Israel's assassination of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah as justice for as many victims. U.S. President said that Washington fully supports Israel's right to defend itself, as he said the airstrike that killed Nasrallah was revenge for the deaths of thousands of Americans, Israelis and Lebanese civilians. It's about, Emma, how they retaliate, what Hezbollah does next, and Iran.
Yeah, I mean, this is marks another alarming escalation in the conflict. And also the question of what this does to Hezbollah's kind of top command. Israel have now eliminated, I think it's 17 of the top tranche of leaders. And of course, you know, you don't eliminate the ideology, and there are plenty more who will step up. But, you know, perhaps less politically savvy, less experienced people coming through now. And also, I think the international response is really interesting. You know, do we feel any confidence in Joe Biden in his current state, and Keir Starmer with David Lammy as our foreign secretary? And does it really matter? I mean, I think probably the axis of kind of influence has shifted away from the US and the UK now, and is it actually in other places?
Eva?
I mean, it certainly is a question about what happens next. I mean, Netanyahu has now said that the score has been settled and you know, that phrase would, you know, arguably seem, okay, right, we're good for now. However, it does see, you know, Israel before has, you know, conceded, and then it has gone on to launch another bombing campaign. There's already been 1,000 lives claimed in Lebanon. You've got the Iran supreme leader calling on Muslims around the world to seek revenge. Biden's urging Tehran to pull back from the brink. But at the same time, Kamala Harris, you know, president potentially elect, is saying that, you know, this leader who was killed has American blood on his hands. All of this language is you know, it potentially can escalate an extraordinarily febrile situation. I haven't actually seen a UK response from it yet. I haven't seen anything come into my inbox. You know, Netanyahu, it's thought that he was attempting this quick bombing campaign to eliminate the leader, and then that would mean there would be no ground offensive. But, you know, events before would suggest that he's not necessarily one to stick by his word. So potentially we're looking at, you know, a huge bombing campaign in Lebanon. It's very frightening for geopolitics.
Well, Dr. Tariq Abu Jordeh is from Lebanon and is a lecturer in comparative politics at Queen's University Belfast. Good evening.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
It's good to talk to you, Tariq. How significant is this moment?
Oh, I mean, I think this is definitely, I would say, the most crucial moment in the Lebanese-Israeli conflict, at least since 2006, the war of 2006. One could argue maybe even more significant than that, going back all the way to 2000 and Israel's retreat from southern Lebanon. I mean, the killing of such a significant leader that's been the leader of Hezbollah from the 1990s, and not only in terms of kind of just his long-standing nature of his leadership, but what Hezbollah has grown into under his leadership from, you know, not to use kind of a crude phrase, but a kind of plucky resistance movement, kind of semi-structured militia, to this regional and international player that can shape civil wars in Syria or in Yemen, whose influence stretches as far as Venezuela, who has managed, at least up until recently, what was perceived to be kind of the security balance with an enemy kind of as militarily capable as Israel. It's a huge moment, you know, cutting off a leader that's been in power for so long.
I've been broadcasting quite a lot about this, even tonight, and I still don't quite understand myself, Tariq. Maybe you can help me. Is this the beginning of the end of the war? Or is this just the start?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, that's kind of the million-dollar question. Up until this point, it felt like it was really the escalation was kind of down to the two parties, to Hezbollah on one side and to Israel on the other. And then we've seen kind of this display of the asymmetry of power, you know, for the favor of the Israeli side. And it does seem that it is kind of in their hands all the way. You know, I mean, we've known that is the case. I mean, the attacks on you know, Hezbollah's communication systems through pagers and through, you know, radio devices and walkie-talkies showed just how far Israel had penetrated Hezbollah's networks. And not only that, but also kind of the impunity that Israel can move in, you know, blowing up those devices when there was no way really for the Israeli authorities to ascertain their locations, and effectively what could tantamount, you know, amount to a war crime, because, you know, as many civilians, if not more, were hurt by the operation. It does seem like there is a free hand there. You know, the US has been calling for a ceasefire. The Iranians have shown all kinds of restraint, you know, relatively speaking, obviously. And it's now kind of down to Israel. Is it satisfied with the killing of Nasrallah? Can it claim that its citizens can now kind of move back to the north, which was the official aim of this campaign? Now it is in Israel's hands.
And Israel have said that they won't stop until they have the total destruction of Hezbollah. What would that look like? Would that have to be an official surrender? Or what is an official destruction of this group? And would Iran let that happen?
I mean, that's a very good question, because Hezbollah operates in a very nuanced way, especially within Lebanon. Obviously, its whole kind of raison d'etre is resistance to Israel is this fight for officially freedom, you know, the liberation of chunks of Lebanese lands that it claims that Israel still occupies, and then regionally playing a part in this kind of what it calls the axis of resistance and, you know, liberating Palestinian lands, etc. That kind of depends on, you know, only the Israeli authorities will be able to answer that question, because Hezbollah also operates politically, you know, in a, let's say, a civil and less military way within Lebanon as well. It participates in its parliament, in its government, it has ministers, it has strong support base. What happens to that? You know, can Hezbollah now, you know, assuming Israel is claiming, okay, well, we're getting rid of all the leadership, all the missiles are obviously still there, a lot of the arms are still there. We've seen that today because the barrage is going back and forth. At what point do you stop? And how? Who fills that vacuum? Who fills that gap? You know, that leadership.
Well, will there be a power struggle within the leadership of Hezbollah? Is there a natural leader to emerge?
Well, it seems at least organizationally that they have had, just from today, obviously this is all still very fresh, but there is a system whereby you, because it's obviously not just Nasrallah that's been killed, you know, they've claimed to have killed basically all the top brass. But there does seem at least there is still some command taking place, some command structure, because we've seen rockets still being fired today towards Jerusalem and the likes. So there is that on the other hand, but there's definitely a leader that strong will leave such a huge gap that there is going to be a power struggle, and that power struggle is not only internally Lebanese, but also with those regional players, with the likes of Iran, with even the Syrian regime, which still has traces of power within Lebanon, within Hezbollah itself.
You mentioned, and by the way, Eva and Emma, if you've got a question, feel free to come in with it. You mentioned, Tariq, that Iran has shown restraint. How humiliated is Iran, and why are they showing restraint? And do you think they will continue to do so?
Well, again, you know, restraint obviously being a relative word. A few months ago, they obviously had that, you know, they sent all, I can't remember the exact number now, was it dozens or hundreds of drones towards Israel? But then at the same time, it said that it notified both the US and the United Nations because this was a retaliation strike. So obviously resistance being a very relative word here. I think at least from the start of, you know, from 7th October onwards, they have indicated by all means that they do not want this escalation into a regional war. And if I were to kind of hazard a guess, I would say it's because that would involve a direct involvement from the Americans. And that's something where they don't see themselves coming out, as victors in, at least not at the moment. Now, this is definitely much more of a direct attack on Iran's regional power, on Iran's literal military organization, because obviously Hezbollah is tied not only kind of ideologically, but also militarily, also from its command structure to Iran. And a member of the Revolutionary Guards was obviously killed with a strike that killed Hassan Nasrallah. So there is definitely a humiliation that's taking place. They've already kind of vowed revenge. But again, based on what we've seen so far, that's been more talk than action. It's really hard to see where they go from here.
The Sunday Times tomorrow is talking about this. Their front page headline is Israel strikes huge blow but braces for revenge. And it quotes Iran's supreme leader calling on Muslims around the world to seek revenge following the assassination of the Lebanese cleric. I'm reading from the paragraph, a figurehead for Shia resistance against Israel for over three decades.
None of that is new. I mean, we know it's a tit for tat. We know this is why it's such a tinderbox. You know, we know that you keep on getting retaliation after retaliation. We know that Benjamin Netanyahu has been bent on revenge since the killing of his brother for what, 47 years? It must be 47 years. So this is the rhetoric they use, in terms of calling for Muslims around the world to seek revenge following the assassination of Nasrallah. This is the language that they use, Stephen.
I'm reading more of the article here. All eyes, says the Sunday Times, are now on Tehran, where Ayatollah Al-Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, was spirited away to a secure location following Nasrallah's death, two officials told Reuters, Tariq.
Yes, I mean,
how do you see this?
Go on,
Go ahead, Eva, of course.
Where do you think the UK goes from here? The US has sent extra support to the region and Biden's been very strong on it. Where does the UK play in all of this?
I'm assuming that that question is addressed towards me.
Yes. Sorry.
Well, I mean, listen. Unfortunately, and I'm coming at it from a Lebanese academic, I suppose, in this scenario, I don't see the UK to have had obviously much of an effect, unfortunately, diplomatically, and that's, you know, not just kind of a belittlement of UK foreign policy or just, you know, foreign influence and power. The US doesn't seem to have been able to achieve many of its diplomatic objectives either. Now, obviously, the UK has its own interest there. Now, under a new government, there is much more room for it to play a part. That vacuum that's been filled that I've mentioned, there is room for international players to also fill in that gap as well. The fact is, the West has failed so far in its diplomacy, and Eva mentioned the very good point, which is this rhetoric just keeps getting more and more inflammatory. It's just a question of tit for tat. It's about justice for this and justice for that. And the fact is, they failed, you know, massively at keeping heads cool or level or any kind of potential for a ceasefire. That's why I personally just feel that it will come down to the power holders that are more directly invested. The likes of Israel and Iran will have to, dumb down their rhetoric or decrease their level of barrage, whether militarily or in the media or, you know, again, rhetorically.
And Tariq, isn't it the case that we have almost no influence really now? I mean, Netanyahu recently has been talking about how David Lammy's decisions as our foreign secretary were very, very unhelpful. And surely now the power is sort of the kind of influence is coming from China and Russia and even Turkey, but not from the US and the UK anymore.
Yeah, so again, I would say that is definitely more the case with obviously the UK than the US, but I have been both surprised and kind of disappointed at how little influence the US, who obviously is such a staunch ally of Israel, has had on said ally. You know, kind of not being able to force any kind of restraint or in some cases adherence to international law at all. And instead, it seems to be this kind of very realist foreign policy game of, you know, who's got the bigger missile? And it's as simple as that. And a complete tit for tat, not just in terms of the violent rhetoric, but also, basically, effectively, now we're playing this kind of refugee game. How many internally displaced people in Lebanon versus internally displaced people in Israel? And it's become kind of very, this kind of realpolitik nightmare.
Tariq, thank you for joining us this evening. Tariq's from Queen's University in Belfast. We appreciate your analysis tonight. We'll pause there. We'll get the news at 11:32.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
With the headlines, I'm John Wilkinson. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the killing of the Hezbollah leader is a historic turning point that would help Israel achieve its war goals. Hassan Nasrallah was killed last night in Israeli strikes on Beirut, but Hezbollah says the loss of its leader will not stop it fighting. President Biden says Nasrallah's death was a measure of justice for his victims, but the US would continue working to de-escalate the conflict. Meanwhile, Iran's supreme leader has declared 5 days of mourning for his ally and said his death will not go unavenged. The Canterbury MP, Rosie Duffield, has quit the Labour Party and will sit as an independent. She's criticised the Prime Minister's decision to keep the two-child benefit cap and introduce means testing for the winter fuel payment for pensioners in England and Wales. And more than 60 people have died in Nepal after torrential rain triggered widespread flooding. Rescuers have saved around 1,000 people, but many are still unaccounted for after landslides swept away homes. Here is your sports. Liverpool are back on top of the Premier League after a 2-1 win at bottom of the table Wolves. Mohamed Salah scored the winner, converting from the penalty spot. The Wolves boss Gary O'Neill says one lapse of concentration after they had equalised proved crucial.
Disappointed that we went off plan for about a minute, where just after we scored, for some reason we get carried away and caught in the emotion of it and go chasing and open the game up once, really, and get punished for a penalty. Apart from that minute where we lost our way and went chasing and opened the game up, I thought the lads were excellent.
Manchester City and Arsenal are a point behind Liverpool. Arsenal needed 2 stoppage time goals to beat Leicester City 4-2 at the Emirates, while City were held to a 1-1 draw by Newcastle. City's Mateo Kovacic says a point at St James's Park is not a disaster, though.
Tough game, yeah, as always. When we come here, it's always a tough place. It was a good game, apart obviously from the result. We wanted to come here to win, but here, tough plays and the point is never bad.
The individual performance of the day was Cole Palmer's. He scored four times in the first half as Chelsea beat Brighton 4-2. But one particular bit of praise didn't do very much for him.
Yeah, I just try to play every game best as I can and hopefully pull off performances like that today.
Theo Walcott's doing Match of the Day tonight. He's been saying that he thinks there's a bit of Dennis Bergkamp about the way that you play. How do you feel about that sort of analysis?
Yeah, I know he's a legend of the Premier League, but I didn't really watch him. I think I was too young.
But makes me feel old.
I've seen clips and stuff, so yeah, he's a top player, but thank you, Theo Walcott.
Everton got their first league win of the season, beating Crystal Palace. Brentford and West Ham drew 1-1. Fulham were 1-0 winners at Nottingham Forest. Celtic are back on top of the Scottish Premiership. The defending champions won 6-0 at St Johnstone to replace Aberdeen, who had earlier beat Dundee 2-1. Further afield, the England captain Harry Kane injured his ankle as Bayern Munich drew with Bayer Leverkusen. Bayern play Aston Villa in the Champions League on Wednesday. Terry Harper is the new WBO World Lightweight Champion. She's beaten fellow Englishwoman Rhiannon Dixon in Sheffield to become a three-weight world champion.
There were some tough points in the fight and I still had to remember what I was here for and dig down, and it's part of the boxing world title. You're going to get buzzed. So I just took the round off, recovered, and luckily I'm fit and healthy, so I managed to recover quick and get back to work.
Rugby Union's world champion South Africa have won their first rugby championship since 2019, beating Argentina by 48 points to 7. In the Premiership, there were wins for Harlequins, Northampton and Saracens. Cardiff and Ospreys won in the United Rugby Championship. In women's rugby, Scotland begun the defence of their WXV2 title with a 19 points to 0 win over Italy. Wales, though, lost to Australia. Warrington Wolves are into Super League's playoff semi-finals after scoring a drop goal in golden point extra time to beat St Helens. They'll play Hull KR in the semis. And Mark Selby has beaten Mark Allen to set up a British Open snooker final against John Higgins. That is the latest from BBC Sport, and you can listen on your smart speaker by saying play BBC Sport News.
Matt Shawley,
BBC Radio 5 Live.
We are looking for a member of Matt's Parliament for New Forest East. Mick has got a claim. Hello, Mick.
In 1997, I proposed in a little hotel. I was actually in the bathroom.
What?
We were getting ready for dinner and I wanted it all to be sort of sorted before we went in and celebrated.
Lisa Nadi, such a safe culture major talk.
We're toughening up the system to make sure that people who are unfit owners can't become football club owners.
Matt Shawley,
Monday to Friday from 2
on BBC Radio 5 Live.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
We feel totally betrayed.
Welcome to Murrayfield.
I listen to you guys all the time.
Stephen Nolan.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Well, Eva and Emma are helping us through tomorrow morning's newspapers. Not surprisingly, the situation with Hezbollah's chief assassination is making the front pages of most of the papers tomorrow. If we turn to The Observer, Iran threatens vengeance over Hezbollah chief's assassination is what they're going with. So how are Hezbollah's backers in Iran going to respond to what's happened? Well, Camelia Entek Carbifard is the editor-in-chief of the Independent Persian and joins us from New York tonight. Camelia, what are you expecting Iran to do next?
Thank you very much for hosting me, dear Stephen. The next, it would be lots of tension in the region. And I can speculate that perhaps after the 5 days national mourning that it called from the supreme leader in Iran, and they would come up with a plan to make a confrontation or get revenge from Israel. Now we are hearing from the hardliners how regret from not responding on time when Ismail Haniyeh assassinated in Tehran, and blaming Mohammad Javad Zarif and Pezeshkian's government that when they traveled to New York, they didn't show that strength and support which Hezbollah and Hassan Nasrallah needed. I believe since Joseph Borrell also says, he said no one can stop Netanyahu with the plan the Prime Minister of Israel has to expand the operation. It seems like Iran would take some decisions to confront Israelis. I don't know how, but I believe that they will respond.
The Supreme Leader of Iran has declared 5 days of mourning for Nasrallah. Can we expect anything to happen during that mourning period, Camelia?
Not sure, right? Two times the national security team had a meeting, and that meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei is head of the national security meeting. I don't know if he has had his own present at the meeting, but definitely from wherever he is, he was leading the team members and discussing the situation. The 7th of October is the anniversary of the war which Hamas attacked Israel. Let's say after these 5 days of the mourning, maybe there is a better picture for the Iranian to want to take the revenges after that. I'm not sure if during these five days they would act against of Israelis. They would little bit wait to see exactly how they should respond.
Do you think... Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Emma. Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask Camelia, from her perspective, what would be safer for the region, a Trump victory, a Donald Trump victory, or Kamala Harris in November?
Hard to say, but I believe the regional people prefer President Trump. Even today, when we are seeing Hassan Nasrallah has been killed, and there are many people are jubilant, even if they cannot show publicly, it comes from what President Trump done against of Qasem Soleimani. After he was killed in Iraq, the seeds of weakening Hezbollah and the revolution regards began to be planted. The person who replaced Qasem Soleimani, Ismail Qaani, he is not a capable man. He doesn't have this charm, not this connection with the militia, not that experience that Soleimani has, and lots of these weaknesses which we're seeing that this militia are separated apart comes from the absentee of Soleimani. So at this point, we have to credit President Trump what he has the action he has taken against Soleimani. So they were seeing Trump, perhaps it just does take the decision, the Republican, let's say, and Trump better than Democrat based on this 3 years and a half of Biden.
What is Iran's end game here?
What is that Iran ends comes here?
What is their end game?
We had Mahsa revolution in Iran 2 years ago, right? And then the regime confronted enormous challenges with public, with Iranian. This demonstration almost gets so close to overturn the system, the regime. And then Ebrahim Raisi killed somehow in a very suspicious plane crashes, which it was another challenges for this system. And economical challenges, all of them, it not giving them this sign that they can really take a big scale confrontation with Israelis and Americans, which it comes to support them. Here, that's what I said. They might take some steps, but it wouldn't be major unless they want to take a very big risk of the escalation. Otherwise, they are not in a stage to want to take a risk. Hezbollah is almost over, and Israelis are keen to even just tackle the situation in Syria and Iraq. And I'm not seeing that the Islamic Republic wants to take a major risk.
Camelia, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. We appreciate it. Thank you. Let's come back to our national newspapers. Emma and Ava, having a look through them. What about this Boris Johnson story from Page Telegraph? Boris, I'm no longer sure medieval lockdowns defeated COVID, is the headline. This is a continuation of Boris plugging his book. Unleashed, he has described it. The article reads, Boris Johnson has said he no longer is sure lockdowns played a decisive role in defeating COVID, describing the pandemic restrictions as literally medieval in their savagery and consequences. He likened himself to King Canute and questioned whether it was possible for government action to repel the waves of a highly contagious disease. He also said he now believes the disease emerged from a Chinese laboratory leak rather than from a transmission in a wildlife market, Ava.
Yes, this is a rather extraordinary intervention, and one that seems slightly coincidental as the Conservative Party conference has just gotten underway this weekend. And, you know, there are several Conservative MPs who are fighting for the leadership as we speak. So it does feel like an interesting timing of this intervention, particularly when you think about him still being a very popular figure in the Conservative Party. And, you know, Boris Johnson, as a former newspaper editor, former columnist, magazine editor, I should say. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to spin the press and he knows how to get a headline. But I think, you know, I've been looking at the reaction from some of the more leading figures in the anti-lockdown debate, and I don't think this is going to be enough to convince him that he's the right person to come back and lead the Conservative Party.
Do you think that's what's in his head? A comeback?
I think there's certainly, with Boris Johnson, there's certainly, and it's the same thing with Liz Truss, there's certainly this sense that what they wanted to achieve wasn't achieved. And, you know, a lot of people who enter politics would like their ending to be glorious and to be celebrated. And I think both of those figures don't quite feel that they got that and they'd like another go.
Emma?
Well, I worked in publishing for 10 years, and I'm afraid I don't think it's even that exciting. I think it's it's pure and simple, pulling the juicy bits out of the memoir, which he's finally written, he's finally completed. And we've had the Prince Harry thing. Oh, I had a man-to-man talk with Prince Harry, which is absolute nonsense because it was a chat at a conference, and literally Harry was almost on his way to the airport. He left the following day. Boris Johnson didn't try and convince Prince Harry not to leave. He didn't try and prevent Mexit. That's just a headline. This is a tease. This is what you do with memoirs. I mean, this lockdown nonsense from Boris Johnson now actually makes me feel incredibly angry for him to casually, you know, as Eva says, while flogging his memoir, which I think publishes in October. There I go, giving it a plug. I don't know why I gave it a plug. But anyway, The idea that he can casually kind of lob out there, just the way that Chris Whitty did the other day. Oh, yeah, maybe we got it wrong. Maybe lockdowns were too severe. When you think about the impact that lockdowns had on people's lives, when you think about how it destroyed the economy, how it destroyed a generation of children, babies, and young people's lives.
What do you want out of Chris Whitty? Well, what do you want out of Chris Whitty? Isn't it better that he's being honest, that now, with the benefit of hindsight, he's admitting maybe you got it wrong? How he feels, what's wrong with him being honest about it?
Maybe they did. And at the time, those of us that were saying this day in, day out, people were investigated. People were put on blacklists. People were told they were idiots and they didn't understand the science. Sorry, he's the chief medical officer. He should have been judging things. No, Stephen, when you look at the magnitude of what they did, that the fact that they locked us in our houses, the fact that people died and were not able to be with their mother, with their husband, with the person that they loved in hospitals. And then you had Matt Hancock WhatsApping people about, let's scare the pants off the public. No, I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's right. I don't think Boris Johnson should be chucking this stuff out there casually. You know, as for him talking about the market and the Wuhan lab leaks, he doesn't know. Well, I'm trying to think of a polite way of saying it. He doesn't know his bottom from his elbow on this. And
well,
on
he would have been
and on
clear,
where it
clearly
came
then.
From the Chinese lab leaks. He doesn't know anything. Frankly,
well, clearly,
I mean, I wasn't originally anti-Boris, but lockdown made me extremely angry when you see the impact it had on people's lives. And I don't think this country has recovered. I don't think it will recover. I think it destroyed society. I think it destroyed the economy. But the people's mental health. Sorry, it's too serious for this. You can't be joking about this stuff.
Final word to you, Eva, very briefly.
Well, I mean, you know, I think there was also an extraordinary revelation actually a couple of days ago in the Daily Mail that Boris Johnson had thought about sending in the army into Holland to go and rescue some COVID vaccines that were meant to come to the United Kingdom. I think basically what this memoir is showing us is that perhaps the Prime Minister didn't have the best judgment and wasn't too good at running the show.
Okay. Eva and Emma, thank you very much indeed. That's our Saturday night paper review. That's a heads up as to what's across the papers that are being delivered onto the doorsteps tomorrow morning. Now next, thousands of Lebanese people are displaced tonight, many sleeping on the streets after the Israeli attacks which killed Hezbollah leader Nassan Hezbollah. It's been the focus of our broadcasting tonight. Effie Higgins, the deputy representative of UNICEF Lebanon, is in Beirut and has been explaining the humanitarian situation in the city.
Well, unfortunately, the situation here in Beirut is and continues hour by hour to rapidly worsen. The humanitarian situation is really now nothing short of catastrophic. Just since Monday, we have had the government has had to open 763 shelters for all of the displaced people that are arriving. But unfortunately, even this is not sufficient. We have hundreds of thousands of people who are now displaced, fleeing the increased bombardment in the south of the country and also around, especially since yesterday, the bombardments around Beirut. So last night at 2 and 3 in the morning, populations received evacuation orders. So all throughout the night, we have seen thousands of people pouring onto the streets, parents pulling their children out of bed, just in their pajamas and going with whatever they were wearing. So there's a very, very dire situation unfolding where people are in need of absolutely everything and it's unsafe for them to return to their homes for now. So of the over 700 shelters that have opened, it's not sufficient. Over 500 of them are already full and we still have people sleeping under bridges, sleeping on the sides of roads, sleeping in cars, sleeping in any space where they can seek assumed safety and protection. We estimate that approximately 22,000 families are now in these shelters. Some of these are schools, some are community centres, and they're wholly unsuitable for housing families over the, over an extended period of time. They don't have showers, they don't have any proper facilities. So it's really a very, very challenging. We've seen over 6,000 people injured just in the last 12 days alone and over 1,000 people killed. And for example, on Monday, it was the deadliest day for children in Lebanon over the past 18 years. And we had more than 50 children killed in one day. So it is really a very, very dire situation.
And you say that it is deteriorating hour by hour. Can you tell me why it's deteriorating that quickly? What is happening from one hour to the next?
Well, what is happening is that the areas that are under bombardment are growing. So families are fleeing their homes. More and more families are having to flee their homes. They're receiving evacuation orders. Hospitals are receiving evacuation orders. So even in the last 4 hours, 4.5 hours, we've had two hospitals in the south of Lebanon have been hit. I just finished speaking to my colleague tonight to try to get water for a hospital that's full of patients. And it's very, very, the access is extremely difficult to get there to deliver a water tanker because the fuel has run out. So we are not able to pump any water from the pumping stations because that has all been completely depleted.
What will happen to the people who need it? What will they do?
Yeah, I mean, from the UNICEF side, we're doing our best to get tankers of water there immediately, but not only into that hospital, which I'm just using as an example, but to the wider population and hundreds of thousands of people that are now in need. A massive humanitarian response needs to be activated immediately. Our resources that we had pre-positioned will run out in a matter of days if some are already depleted. So we really need to continue to scale up. We've been on the ground. Teams have been really doing very perilous distributions in some areas, distributing medical supplies, distributing food, water, hygiene kits, mattresses, blankets, clothes for children, but we need to do much, much more in the hours and days ahead. So we are extremely concerned about the safety and well-being of children right across the country, really call for a ceasefire so that this conflict comes to an immediate end and we don't see further destruction.
Your team must be exhausted.
Indeed, the team have been working night and day to try to, order more supplies. When it's depleted from the local market, we're getting more. We're flying in more. We have 100 metric tons of medical supplies was flown in last week and distributed urgently to hospitals. We're now looking at other neighbouring countries to bring in more supplies when markets have run out here locally. But staff, it is very, very difficult. Many of them are concerned and are relocating their own families. Sadly, we lost two UNHCR staff members this week. So it is very, very dangerous for them as well. In many cases. UNICEF has been here for many decades delivering assistance and support for the Palestinian refugees in the Palestinian camps, but also for over 1 million Syrian refugees that have been in Lebanon for over a decade and hosted by Lebanon. So they themselves were in a crisis prior to this current conflict. So really what we're seeing is a country veering from a humanitarian crisis into a catastrophe. Even prior to this war, we had 700,000 children out of school, and now children should be going back to school this month, but instead the schools have all been turned into shelters. So it's very tragic, not just for the children's well-being today, but also for their future.
And finally, when you got up this morning, if you got much sleep at all last night, can you describe literally what you saw on the ground?
Indeed, last night was a very, very long night and very traumatic for a lot of people in Lebanon, who, especially those who had lived through the Beirut blast in 2020. It was extremely difficult the last 24 hours. So this morning what we saw was we saw thousands of people on the streets. I received many, many calls from colleagues saying in different parts of the city saying we need to get here, we need to get supplies here, not just in Beirut, but even in the south where we had migrants and refugees and Lebanese stranded without support. I saw smoke rising from the horizon exactly as it was in the evening when the sun went down. It was the same when the sun came up this morning, with new plumes of smoke and a thick layer of smoke hanging across the city. And the city was kind of eerily quiet in some areas, and then with very little traffic because people were just congregating and sleeping in their cars and trying to get their children to sleep and to rest on the ground. We had staff who were out last night trying to direct people who were displaced to shelters that we knew were open. It was very, very difficult to do that throughout the night because the bombardment, I think we had a lot of strikes. So it was very difficult to direct everyone safely to a shelter last night.
And are children displaced from their parents?
We, as UNICEF, one of our core mandates is to make sure that we ensure the protection of children, especially during acute humanitarian crises such as this. And indeed, we're tragically finding more and more unaccompanied and separated children. So yesterday, the team and I were discussing how to support one little girl who lost 15 members of her family, and we were unable to find other members of her extended family because they had been displaced twice already. So we had to trace back to try to find some members of her family. We haven't succeeded yet, but we'll continue and we'll pursue and hope to reunite her with some members of her extended family, given that she's already lost so many members of her family. And we've made short-term alternative care arrangements for her, so she's in a safe place. But unfortunately, the longer this goes on and the more acute the humanitarian crisis, the more cases like this we will definitely come across.
Thank you very much indeed, Etty, for speaking to me tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
And that brings the programme to an end from us for tonight. Thanks to the team, Sam and Nat in the studio, Leona and Jack taking your calls, Judy, Julia and Jason at producing, and Adrian was editing tonight. Lisa McCormick's here throughout the night from 1 o'clock. We're back tomorrow night, Sunday night as usual, at 10 o'clock. So enjoy your Sunday and I'll see you tomorrow night. Night-night everyone, and thanks very much for listening.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at midnight. This is Richard Lawson. President Biden has reiterated his calls for a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah after the Iranian-backed group confirmed the death of Hassan Nasrallah in Israeli airstrike. Speaking to reporters in the American state of Delaware, Mr. Biden said the death of Hezbollah's leader was a measure of justice for his victims. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said his killing was necessary to achieve his country's war goals.
At the start of the week, I came to the conclusion that the intense blows the Israeli military struck Hezbollah within the past days, these blows will not be enough. Nasrallah's assassination was an essential condition to achieving the goals we set. Returning safely the residents of the north to their homes and changing the balance of power in the region over the years.
Well, Iran has promised to avenge Hassan Nasrallah's death, stoking fears of regional escalation. The Israeli military said they intercepted a missile fired by the Houthis in Yemen. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner says a full-blown regional conflict in the Middle East wouldn't be in anyone's interest, but is possible.
It really hinges on three questions. What will Hezbollah do next? What will Iran and its proxies do next? And what will Israel do next? So in the case of Hezbollah, they are hurt, they're bleeding, their weapons dumps have been blown up, but they've still got a very big arsenal buried below ground, which includes these long-range missiles. Now, there will be some in their ranks who are baying for blood. The question is, do they unleash this big long-range arsenal of missiles trying to overwhelm Israel's air defences on cities like Tel Aviv? They could probably do that, but the response from Israel would be catastrophic for Lebanon.
Millions of Americans are still without power and face severe flooding in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene. One of the most powerful storms to ever hit the United States battered the southeast with heavy rains and winds up to 140 miles per hour. The police have charged three people with the murder of a man who was stabbed to death in Norwich. The body of 19-year-old Calvin Taylor was found in a flat last Saturday. Sport now, Liverpool.